This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates for the seventh time in a year. That's big news, but it's news many of us don't really understand, even though it will probably affect our own finances. My guest William Grider says every time the Fed makes a move, there are winners and losers. He's been writing about the Fed for years because it controls the nation's supply of money and credit. Grider says it's the Fed, not the president, that steers the economy. Grider is the National Affairs Correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine, and he has an article about rising interest rates in the current issue. He's also the author of the book The Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. Here's something a lot of people find confusing. The economy has been growing, which sounds like good news, but the Fed raised interest rates in order to slow down the economy. I asked Grider why the Fed wants to hold back economic growth.
A friend of mine who's an editor at Rolling Stone read these stories in the newspapers and the financial pages about how the economy is growing dangerously too fast. And he was genuinely puzzled. He said, "What's going on? How can this be happening?" And I said, "Well, basically the rich are running the country," which was a flip answer and too simple and slightly unfair to the Federal Reserve, but actually not wrong. I mean, what we are seeing is a drama that has played out again and again over the last 20 years, in which the Federal Reserve becomes the governor of the economy and decides really unilaterally that there is some hidden threat of inflation, that is price inflation, lurking in the healthy growth of the economy. And so this time, unlike previous episodes, they have taken a preemptive strike against that possibility. They are literally slowing down the economy, which is now running at about 4% real growth a year. Their goal is to take it down to about 2-2.5% a year. And their logic is that if you create a little more unemployment and you knock the edge off consumer demand sufficiently, then those dangerous inflationary pressures won't develop.
What are the dangerous inflationary pressures?
Well, this is even more puzzling, probably to average citizens. The dangerous inflationary pressures, which do not yet appear in the American economy, but which they worry about, are rising wages. Most people, I think, have now read or understand in their own terms that real wages in the American economy have, on average, been declining for quite a few years. That is, you get your nominal paycheck, and it may be going up. But once you've deducted inflation and other things from it, you're actually losing ground. Your real income is subsiding. So, and that condition continues to this day, despite the healthy economy. So what they are doing is saying that's going to reverse dangerously, and somehow labor unions and individuals who can bargain up their wages are going to demand more, and that will put the squeeze on business, and business will then be forced to raise its prices in order to maintain its profit margins. And once that gets going across the whole economy, we have not 2.7% inflation, but 4 or 5% inflation, and pretty soon 6, 7, 8% inflation. This is a scenario that I'm not alone in this. A lot of economists think this is wildly improbable and really recreating a fantasy from the past, namely the 1970s, when inflation did indeed accelerate out of control.
So on the one hand, the Fed is saying the economy is growing too fast. That could lead to inflation, so we're going to slow down the growth of the economy by raising the interest rates.
Yeah, and it works very directly. If you're, say, a young homeowner with an adjustable rate mortgage, you have already been hit a number of times. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates 6 times in the last year, basically doubled short-term interest rates, and they raised them again yesterday. And that goes, with a little bit of a lag, that goes right on your monthly mortgage payment. And I've seen various numbers kicked around, but my guess is that I mean, nobody is typical, but probably somewhere in the middle range of homeowners, that's cost folks $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 a year. They don't spend that money on other things, and that's the effect the Federal Reserve wants.
You say that the Fed actually picks the winners and losers when the Fed creates its monetary policy. So who are the winners and losers, the way you see it, when the Fed raises interest rates as it's been doing for the past year?
Well, in just in big, broad terms, the winners are people who have wealth, savings, capital, who are the creditors in our society. They lend, and the rate at which they lend their money to others has just been increased quite substantially. The losers are everybody who borrows. And that's not just individuals, but businesses and other institutions that just in the normal course of existence, they're always borrowing and paying back loans. So you've just raised the toll for all of those people. I mean, in fact, that's what the Fed has in mind. It's literally to change the behavior of those borrowers.
I think the middle class probably has more invested in the bond market than ever before because of mutual funds and because of pension funds.
Well, I know that's the widely perceived as the reality. I don't think it's quite true. Let me give you some simple numbers, which are a little over crude, but still capture the picture. A Federal Reserve study of individuals and their financial wealth determined that 85% of the net financial wealth held by individuals, as opposed to banks or universities or whoever, 85% of that is owned by 10% of the families in America. Now, the other 15% is spread across what we call the middle class. But when you get to that still only gets you another 35% of the population. So here's the picture. The net creditors are those 10% of the very, very wealthy, another 35% of people with more modest means, and the other 55% of the families in this society are net borrowers. They're in debt. And so you begin to see the outlines of this transaction. And this is, there's nothing new in this. This inequality of wealth has existed for quite a long time. But the policies of the Federal Reserve reward one side of that ledger and penalize the other.
When we look at what a healthy economy means, and therefore what monetary policy should be, does a healthy economy mean something different, say, for a middle-class wage earner as it means for, say, somebody with a lot of investments? Does it mean one thing for a consumer and something else for the owner of a business?
It does. And the fulcrum is between those wealth holders, the bondholders and others who have long-term investments, whether in treasury bonds or corporate bonds or other forms. And they live in mortal fear of inflation. So they are constantly pounding on the central bank, the Federal Reserve, to be vigilant, to not let inflation even get started.
And what's their worry about inflation?
Well, in over 20 years, the value of their stored wealth will be depreciated if money is depreciated, so that you buy a bond for $1,000 in 1995 and sell it 10 years later and you discover that in real terms it's really only worth two-thirds of that or half of that because of price inflation. And this is the basic mechanism that keeps them always hyper alert to the possibilities of inflation. On the other side, inflation for wage earners may actually mean rising wages. They will also perhaps lose from the depreciation of money values, but in a very direct sense, they win from faster economic growth.
Because their wages go up.
Wages go up, there's more employment, there's more opportunity, there's more consumption.
And just explain for me how an increase in wages would also increase inflation.
Well, it doesn't necessarily increase inflation. That's the conservative view of the economy that that the Federal Reserve embraces, but it's a very complex and disputed point. The theory is if enough people in the society, if labor markets become tight, then unions and others can bid up wages and demand higher pay, and then the employers have to pass that on, which means they raise their prices, and pretty soon you have a general inflation underway. One of the powerful counterarguments to that today is the global economy. It may have been true 30 years ago that the steel sector or the auto industry or retailers of various kinds could defend their profits by just raising prices unilaterally and setting off inflationary spirals. It's clearly not true today. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal today about the steel industry. They've got a healthy market going. They're selling a lot of steel. They raised their prices, and now they're stuck because imports from the global economy are flowing in at a faster pace, and they can't hold that price. That's the dynamic that the opponents like myself are trying to get the Federal Reserve to take seriously. Nobody in this economy, I won't say nobody, but most sectors of this economy are not free of those global pressures anymore. And that's a break on inflation which undermines all of the sort of historic logic of what the Federal Reserve does.
The Federal Reserve raised interest rates for the seventh time in a year yesterday. Is that unprecedented? Is that very unusual?
Not unprecedented. At various times the Fed has moved more cautiously and also much more dramatically. When Paul Volcker came to power in late 1979 and inflation was in double digits, he doubled the price of money in a matter of months, and it went way above the inflation rate. This time, what's unprecedented, I think, is that Greenspan and the Fed are acting without any evidence that there's inflation there. And they're saying, well, we can't see it, you can't see it in the statistics, but we know it's coming. The inflation rate last year in America, consumer price index, rose 2.7%. The same number that appeared the year before and the year before that. When you ask where is the inflation, they will say, well, there's some labor markets that look like they're tightening. But then you point to what's actually happening to wages, and the Labor Department put out a report just yesterday or the day before. The total labor cost, which is wages and benefits, was absolutely flat in 1994, and which is quite extraordinary given that the economy was growing at 4%. And many people, including the auto industry, argue that we're in a new economy now, where the connection between growth and consumer demand and wages just simply isn't the same as the Federal Reserve presumes. And part of that is the global economy. Part of it is greater efficiency in production. Part of it is the fact that notwithstanding what the unemployment numbers show, we all know all over the society, young people, middle-aged people, there are millions of Americans who are not, in their own terms, fully employed. And that's the labor that could be drawn into manufacturing or other enterprises as they continue to grow. That won't happen because the Fed is stepping on the brake.
William Grider is my guest, and he has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine about the Federal Reserve Bank. He's also the author of a book about the Fed called Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist William Grider. He's written a lot about the Federal Reserve Bank, including a book called Secrets of the Temple. Yesterday, the Fed raised interest rates for the seventh time in a year. One of your main points is that the Federal Reserve Bank is the real governor of the economy. It has a lot of power in creating our monetary policy. Who does the Federal Reserve Bank answer to when creating monetary policy?
Well, I think the most sympathetic way to describe the Fed is as a governing institution that's positioned midway between Washington and Wall Street. It is, in hard, concrete terms, it is not accountable to either. But in fact, it listens to both and tries to balance the noise it hears from both ends. Wall Street are the financial markets, which react to Fed policy and also hammer on the Fed governors when they're unhappy with monetary policy. And Washington are the elected politicians. What I have described in the last 15 or 20 years that's quite different from earlier history is that the Fed as a political institution has moved closer and closer to the Wall Street end of that seesaw and further and further away from the democratic political end. And there are lots of deeper reasons why that happened. But that's why you're seeing this drama play out today where financial markets cheer that the Fed is slowing down the economy. The real economy, Main Street, manufacturing, home builders, et cetera, are scratching their heads and saying, why are they doing this to us?
Well, the president appoints the head of the Federal Reserve Bank. Does the head of the Federal Reserve Bank answer directly to the president?
The chairman of the Fed consults with the White House and the Treasury on a regular basis, of course, and tries to stay on good terms with them, but really literally has the power to ignore what the president and the Treasury secretary have to say about any of this stuff, and sometimes to go hard against the administration's own policies.
You say that the Fed is situated somewhere between the White House and Wall Street, and sometimes it listens to Wall Street even more carefully than it listens to the White House. What is the connection between the Fed and Wall Street? Why would the Fed listen so carefully to Wall Street?
There's several layers to that. The most obvious one is that the Fed, by feeding reserves into the banking system, has very precise control over short-term interest rates. And short-term means, say, anything up to 2 years, and whether that's treasury bills or other forms of short-term credit. Long-term credit, particularly when you get out to 20 or 30-year bonds, is not independent of those processes, but is much more able to go its own direction. So that the judgments of the bond market, where those long-term interest rates are set, are like a constant critical review of the Fed's monetary policy. If the Fed cuts interest rates, for instance, and the bond market is upset by that action, it will push long-term rates higher. And Fed governors are loath to go against the bond market because it sounds like the financial mind of the country is giving them a thumbs down on their monetary policy. Now, that's a very simple example. Underneath that, the Fed is responsible as an institution and has been since 1913, when it was created, to defend the soundness of the system. And that's the soundness of the banking system, but also more broadly the financial markets. So it takes up this responsibility and says, we have to do things in a way that keeps markets stable and doing the credit functions that they are there for, and also satisfies investors that we're not debasing the currency.
One more thing before we have to wrap up. You were one of the people featured on a public television show earlier this week that basically offered several critiques of the Bill Clinton presidency. And one of the things that you said, and I'd like to ask you to elaborate on this, is that although you may not share the politics of the Republican majority in Congress now, you think that the Republican control of Congress might lead American politics in a very interesting direction. And I'm just paraphrasing what you said. That is hardly a direct quote. But
right.
Let me ask you to elaborate on what you meant.
Well, I have said and written that it's easy for me to say this because I'm not on food stamps or I'm not in the gun sights of some of the reforms they want to make. But the Republicans are really putting back on the table some very fundamental questions about the nature of the federal government and really the nature of this society. I think a big part of their list, not all of it, but a big part of it is reactionary. I mean, quite literally reactionary in the sense that they would like to roll back to life as it was before the 60s or life as it was before the big government created by the New Deal became an important presence in American economic affairs. Nevertheless, it is simultaneously true that the Democratic majority in Congress had become quite rudderless and ineffective and was locked into sets of relationships of its own that were, if not corrupt, as Newt Gingrich claims, at least pretty decayed and worn out. And so I think it's not bad if we go through a really fundamental debate about the nature of all of these federal programs. The downside of that, of course, is that they are starting with the poor folks. And that's the easy part, in a way, easy from their perspective. You can throw the poor people over the side, and especially we all know they're talking about the poor black people, but will you throw the farmers over the side? Will you throw the major multinationals over the side? Will you throw the wealthy taxpayers who enjoy fabulous tax deductions over the side? I mean, I think that's when the debate gets interesting, if they get that far. If they follow the principles of what they are articulating, they're going to discover that poor people are not the source of the federal deficits. Now, whether they blink at that point and stop or go on will be one of the critical moments.
William Grider, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks.
William Grider is national correspondent for Rolling Stone magazine and author of the book Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.